Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Rip Lehman, professor of English at Florida State University, and we're discussing Morris Dickstein's book, Leopards in the Temple. Rip, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could begin by giving the listener a brief statement of what you think, what you see as the principal thesis or aim of Leopards in the Temple.
Well, this book is important because it does not follow the normal pattern of analysis of fiction in the American 1950s and 60s. Dickstein quite clearly says that political pressures to conform and homogenize American culture from McCarthy and others did not cow American writers of the 50s. That's the first important thing about his book. Another one is that he goes on and shows that there were strong and innovative writers after the war, and he shows that there was a stream of previously outsider writers who brought their work to the table and forced critics to pay attention to them. So to back up on this a little bit and explain it in a different way, what seemed to be a hole in history, in the conventional view, was really a lack of awareness of new writers and their important claims to attention. If I could take a minute, I'd like to just read a passage early in his introduction, which I think expresses in his own words rather eloquently his thesis. Would that be all right?
Sure.
Okay, here goes. Thus began the stream of outsider figures who would do more than anything else to define the character of post-war writing. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, a vibrant voice from the underground rehearsing his own idiosyncratic version of black history. Flannery O'Connor's eccentric misfit, some kind of messenger of God who expresses his frustrations through serial murder, or her displaced person, a European refugee, literally crushed by the do-nothing society he does not begin to understand. Norman Mailer's white Negro, the hipster as moral adventurer and sociopath, the new kind of American saint of Jack Kerouac and the wayward, misunderstood adolescence of J.D. Salinger, the ordinary grunts oppressed by their officers in so many war novels, the anguished old Jews and magical Schlemiel figures in Bernard Malamud's stories, the loopy intellectuals who fill Saul Bellow's fiction with their long memories and sardonic cultural speculations, the refined old-world decadents of Nabokov with their classy style and kinky or comical longings, Philip Roth's protagonists who make grand opera of their sexual needs, exposing the stigmata they received in the gender wars. These characters, all in some way projections of their distinguished authors, are like Kafka's Leopards in the Temple, implosions of the irrational, children of the Freudian century, sharp-clawed primitives who would somehow be integrated into the once decorous rites of American literature, who would become American literature. End quote. So I think that sums up where he's coming from and how he's doing it.
Well, it sounds, by that introduction, that you think there's something insightful, something right about this analysis, something right about this thesis. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about exactly what you do see as right or insightful about it and why.
Well, Dickstein writes very clearly, and so it's welcome to have a writer knowledgeable about American fiction who can write literary criticism of a high order that doesn't bury its points in jargon. And so it's accessible to everyone from the professional right across to the general reader who's trying to figure out important books from mid-century. So that's, you know, one thing that's very important about Leopards in the Temple. A second thing is that it's very generous to writers like Bellow, Saul Bellow, and Norman Mailer, who in the last decade or so have taken a lot of knocks from professional critics because they don't seem to conform to the need to understand everything in terms of French theory. So in one sense there, on this point, he's catching academics up with popular taste. He's turning to authors that have remained popular, like Bellow and Mailer and Salinger and Joseph Heller, and giving academics reason to read them again. Another thing is that he celebrates 50s fiction, that is, fiction that was written in the 1950s, rather than describing it as shallow. Just to remember that it exists and that it's the source of books in the 1960s and 70s is to do it a favor that it deserves, I think. He fills in what I called in a book I wrote a dozen years ago. I called the conventional attitude towards the 1950s a hole in history. And I think Dick Steen wonderfully fills in that hole with smart comments about the fiction that was actually there. And as I've already said, he shows that the Cold War, which most books about the period have argued governed the era, actually did not govern the writers who were important, who have remained important since the 1950s. And I guess last, in this rather long catalog, I would say that he shows how literature was turning inward and describing the interior minds of rather exemplary and thoughtful people during the 50s and 60s and on to 1970. So I could say more about it, but I would say those are his main strengths.
Okay, so to that extent, you think it is a meritorious book. You think it's a book that it's worth people reading.
Oh, yeah, it's important. It's important for people to hear all these things. It's a counterclaim against the direction of a lot of academic writing these days.
Despite the fact that you think that the book has many merits, its clarity, interesting theses, close examination of at least some authors, you also have certain misgivings, maybe a bit too strong, but at least things that you think that he overlooks or doesn't give sufficient attention to. Things which you end up discussing in some depth in your book called Deliberate Speed that you mentioned a moment ago. And for the listener who might be interested, you go into the name of W.T. Lehman in your writing, so if someone wanted to find the book. I wonder if you could maybe give a brief account of what you see as the primary omissions which he makes, and then we can go back and look at each of those elements in more detail.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Every writer has to make decisions about what she or he is going to focus on. And Dick Steen, who's lived all of his life in New York City or Brooklyn, pays mostly attention to urban men and primarily Jewish men, although he also cares about Ralph Ellison and James Baldwin, two black writers. But what he leaves out is noteworthy during the 50s. He leaves out women. There's almost no attention at all to women writers. In the passage I read a few minutes ago from his introduction, he mentions Flannery O'Connor, but that's the last time he mentions her. And, that's a glaring omission in a book that purports to be an account of new voices in American fiction after the war. He also leaves out Westerners, some of whom were quite interesting, and he leaves out Southern writers nearly altogether, with the exception of Tennessee Williams, who most people don't realize wrote fiction. He's thought generally as a playwright, and Dick Steen rather admirably calls attention to some of his fiction. And he leaves out people that are quite important to me, namely the young avant-garde writers, with the exception of Jack Kerouac, who I think he treats rather generously but conventionally. So that's the main point. I would argue that he's focused in certain ways, and in so doing, he leaves out quite a few people. One might say the leopardesses that come to the table in different ways than the leopards do.
Well, okay, so part of the problem is that he's got a thesis that what happens in between 1945 and 1970 is that the outsiders become the insiders. That's the central overarching thesis of his book. And you're saying that there's a whole crew of outsiders who become insiders, most especially women, Southern writers, and Western writers, which he just doesn't address. And to that extent, at least, he doesn't support his thesis in the way that perhaps he ought.
Well, I'm not saying he ought to. I'm saying that other writers, other analysts of the period, might well have focused differently and extended his thesis. He makes his choices, and his book is quite interesting. But other people might have wanted to talk about Eudora Welty or Sylvia Plath or Flannery O'Connor or James Agee and so on, and could well have done so profitably. It's just a matter of what you have time to do, I think.
I mean, he does mention some of these people, but I take it your point is that some he doesn't mention at all, others he just mentions in passing. He doesn't treat in the depth that he does some of the other writers, most especially Jewish males.
That's right, exactly. He goes on at great length about Bellow and Mailer and Heller and Salinger, all of whom are worthy and deserving, but in the process, the proportions force him to leave out writers that we've just named. But there, I think there are other things to say about the book that one might say even about the people that he does deal with, namely that he reads the books as if they're autobiographies, as if they were some way realistic accounts of the various characters that he does attend to in Bellow and Heller and Mailer and Salinger, as if the characters in these fictions are people that readers might try to be like or understand like they understand their uncle or their son or their father. And I think that's a problem when one's reading fiction. He reads this period, which is, in my view, an anti-realistic period in which people are largely understood by their authors sardonically or parodically or very complexly in ways that one doesn't understand one's uncle or son or father. He treats them as if it's possible. For instance, in Heller's books, these characters are clearly stereotypes. In Catch-22, I'm talking about, we're clearly laughing at characters who often don't even have names, like he calls some of the characters the man in white, et cetera. And Dickstein tries to understand these people as if he knew them, and I believe that's a problem. And what I really think is great about a lot of these people, Heller, Kerouac, Mailer, is their style, which was very different from the Hemingways who went before them in the previous generation, the Henry Jameses. And this style, this flowing verbal diarrhea that comes out of these people is something that Dickstein really is not paying much attention to, and it's rather surprising because it's one of the great features of 50s and 60s writing.
Could you say a little bit more about exactly what you mean by style and how the style has changed and perhaps what specifically it is about this style that he doesn't give enough attention to?
Yeah, I can. What happened in the 50s and 60s is that electronic media burgeoned in the West, that is, in the Western Hemisphere, primarily in America. And writers like Heller and Mailer and Kerouac are really attuned to this. They're very oral, A-U-R-A-L, as well as oral, O-R-A-L, people. And they try to capture that explosion of sound, which we generally associate with popular music, but it was also there in late-night radio with preachers blaring crazy sounds. It was there in the explosion of television and new kinds of radios, portable radios that people could carry around with them. And I thought maybe the best way to illustrate this excitement is to read a passage in Norman Mailer's novel, An American Dream, that catches some of this feeling so that you can see the kinds of things which Dickstein passes by silently without noticing. Would that be all right if I read a passage?
Sure.
Okay, this is about a half a page. And what's happened here is that the character in An American Dream, which is a novel which Dickstein does pay attention to and likes quite a bit, and I like it that he likes this book. It's one of my favorite books also. And most critics have not paid much attention to this, so I cheer him on when he talks about An American Dream, but I'm trying to get at a different kind of an attitude in the book than he notices. This guy has just pushed his wife out of a window and killed her out of a high window, and then she lands on the East River Drive. And the police have dragged Stephen Rojak into the police station, and they're interrogating him now. And the reason he's killed his wife is he's having various affairs, one with a jazz singer named Cherry, and one with a German maid named Ruta, and these people show up in this passage. You hear them in the background, and so I'm just naming them ahead of time. His wife's name was Deborah, and she's in the passage. And he's being questioned by a Lieutenant Lesnicki, so there's lots of ethnic names. names here, and sort of symbolic names, names like Cherry and Ruta, who appear in this passage. So we got Rojak talking to us, and he says, "Now I was suddenly aware that there was as much sound as one might find in the dark night ward of a hospital. There was all but a chorus of protest and imprecations and a leathery pistol-shot insistence of the policemen's voices. I could almost have allowed myself to slip into the anteroom of a dream where we were all swimming about in a sea of mud, calling to each other under the crack of rifles and a dark moon. Voices picked up from one another. The old woman wept louder as our uncle across the room began to talk in his whining, stammering voice. And then Ruta, still out of sight behind the partition, picked up something shrill in tone from the old woman's weeping, and the Negro with a smashed-in face was talking faster, nodding his head in rhythm to some beat he'd extracted from the sounds. I wondered if I were in fever, for I had the impression now that I was letting go of some grip on my memory of the past, that now I was giving up my loyalty to every good moment I had had with Deborah and surrendering the hard, compacted anger of every hour when she had spoiled my need. I felt as if I were even saying goodbye to the night on the hill in Italy with my four Germans under the moon. Yes, I felt just as some creature locked by fear to the border between earth and water, its grip, the accumulated experience of a thousand generations, might feel on that second when its claw took hold, its body climbed up from the sea, and its impulse took a leap over the edge of mutation so that now, and at last, it was something new, something better or worse, but never again what it had been on the other side of the instant. I felt as if I had crossed a chasm of time and was some new breed of man. What a fever I must have been in." End quote. I mean, you can hear a kind of energy there and a cueing on other people's sorrows and needs and the kinds of things they're hearing in the world. And he's trying to capture all those feelings in his prose. I wish Dickstein had paid more attention to that kind of impulse in American fiction of the period.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that impulse, because in your book, Deliberate Speed, and also in our conversations, you've talked about the way in which that kind of impulse, the style of fiction during that period, was heavily influenced by, and perhaps also influenced, developments in popular culture, in the arts, in, again, you mentioned earlier, late night radio, the beginnings of television, yep, jazz, cinema. What was it that happened? What was it about this cross-fertilization of ideas, or, again, more particularly, styles, that was so special about this period?
I think what was special about it was the electronic media that came in and was consumer electronic media. That is, it was these kinds of portable radios and portable 45 disc players, 45 RPM disc players and the like. Could spread to every household. Car radios could broadcast this thing. So you were this new culture. So you were never without the sound of these insistent youth culture voices that were partly black, partly white, tuned into black culture. And this thoroughly permeated not only the oral sounds, the soundscape of American life, but also the consciousness. So that these sounds were new, and what was clearly happening was that the queen of the arts, fiction and literary poetry, was being overwhelmed by new, insistent voices that were not cueing on Faulkner and Hemingway and Henry James in the past. They were cueing on new impulses. And those writers who were most aware at the time, and many of them are the ones that Dickstein is talking about, were trying to catch up with this. They were playing catch up with the vitality in the culture that was beyond literature. So I think if you're going to do a thorough job of discussing what's important about literature in the 1950s and 60s, you have to show this catch-up feeling, this sense of competing with new forms, which many of these people took as a real challenge and tried to live up to. Does that answer the question?
Sure. In fact, I'm wondering if we can put a particular example, use a particular example of this influence. One of the books that both you and Dickstein like a lot, talk about a lot, is Ellison's Invisible Man.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you mention in your book is that Ellison was heavily influenced by jazz. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what the origins of that influence was and how it shaped his writing.
Ellison grew up in Oklahoma, and where important jazz styles were played in clubs down the street from where he was going to sleep, and he could hear people playing in the night as his mother was telling him he had to go to sleep. He's written about this in his autobiographical essays. He comes to New York City after dropping out of college and starts haunting the clubs that are there. He becomes one of America's most important jazz critics, actually, before he becomes one of our best novelists. And he is one of the most eclectic, almost octopus-like characters in American literature. He's very well-read in American literature. He says he's learned how to live by reading Hemingway. But he's also jazz literate also. And he's trying to catch up with Charlie Parker and Lester Young and other important players of the period and trying to bring their sound into his prose. One can extend this also and talk about these points in terms of Norman Mailer, too, who Dickstein's, the cover of Dickstein's book is a wonderful picture of jazz musicians at a famous club, avant-garde club in downtown New York called the Five Spot Cafe. Alas, he doesn't go on and talk about that club inside the book, but that's an important image because at the Five Spot Cafe in New York City, painters came together with musicians and writers, and there was this wonderful cross-fertilization going on where they were all talking with each other and learning from each other, primarily trying to learn from African-American culture, which was being broadcast there in the form of jazz musicians. So the Leopards in the Temple is also the new howls in the temple or the new voices that are coming into the temple, and that's a very important idea that Dickstein is really onto. And I, from my point of view, I just wish he'd extended it a bit more.
Well, let me ask him. You use the language that they turn sound into prose, and I'm wondering if this at least is part of what you have in mind, especially in terms of the influence of jazz. That we think of jazz as being improvisational, at least sometimes manic, and at least seemingly disconnected. Without a form. Is that part of what you mean, that the prose itself becomes improvisational, manic, and seemingly disconnected?
Yeah, I really like the qualifiers you put on there, Hugh, because, of course, improvisation is never actually manic. And, in fact, it's not always invented on the spot. It's usually not invented on the spot. There was a wonderful, in the new movie, 8 Mile, about the rap performer Eminem that came out around Christmas time, which is not a great movie, but it has important scenes in it. And you see this white performer cueing on black culture and trying to learn how to perform. And he's down and out, and he's always taking bus rides around the city of Detroit. And you see him pulling out pads of paper and playing with various rhymes and phrases that he's going to use if he ever gets his chance to get up and apparently improvise something on stage. And that's a very important scene that they show, that what seems to be made up on the spot is actually rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and phrases and parts are put together in different ways at different times. And that's what goes on in what people learned at the Five Spot Cafe, I think. They learned to know their song well before they sing it, as Bob Dylan sings in one of his 60s songs. They learned to practice the parts, but then put them together in ways which address the specifics of the moment, which catch the anxieties and the feelings that I think you can see Mailer responding to, or his characters responding to, in that police station as he's being interrogated. So yes, people are learning from jazz. Painters are learning to play with putting things on canvases in ways that they hadn't played with before. Jackson Pollock is a regular at the Five Spot Cafe, and so on. So there was this cross-fertilization going on that was both among the avant-garde arts and also trying to catch up with popular culture in sound and film and the visuality of billboards.
All right, let me ask you. We've just got about 2.5 minutes left. We're running out of time. I want to ask you one quick question. If you were going to pick out a couple of books from the period for the listener who may not have read very many books, could you pick out a couple that you would urge that people read as being exemplary as exemplifying some of these characteristics that you're discussing?
Yeah, I think Catch-22 is still important in ways that 16 talks about. I think Norman Mailer's books are very important, including An American Dream, which I read from at the beginning of the program, and one which Dickstein does not discuss, oddly, at all, that I recall. And that's a novel called Why Are We in Vietnam, which takes place in the mind of a young disc jockey as he's going through his performances for a night. Those are important books. I would recommend books which he doesn't mention. I would get anything by Flannery O'Connor and study that carefully, because I think she's really very important. And finally, I would say Jack Kerouac's fiction is very important, but although I like On the Road, for which he's most famous, really adventurous listeners might want to pick up his posthumously published book called Visions of Cody, which is the fifth attempt to rewrite the On the Road story by Kerouac, and he thought he got it much closer to what he wanted in his book Visions of Cody than he did in the novel On the Road.
All right, I wonder too, if just in the last minute, you have any final thoughts to the listener, either about this particular period, about the ways that you as a literary critic think that we ought to read, view fiction?
Well, I'm not sure I can deal with that in 30 seconds or whatever we have left. What I would like to do is end the discussion championing Dickstein and his general thesis that we need to pay more attention to post-war American literature because it really is important. It is a new beginning in American culture that works in tandem with painting, cinema, photography, jazz, and, of course, rock and roll, probably the most important force of the period in terms of what was really changing people and helping them move along.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Rip Lehman, professor of English at Florida State University, and we've been discussing Morris Dickstein's book, Leopards in the Temple. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.